Battlefields, Reel 3, ignore previous thing, this begins with James Hill.
The next recording is of Brigadier James Hill speaking from 1st, his brigade headquarters, 3rd Parachute Brigade, at Chateau Menil, which was sighted about 100 metres behind the Fiba, throughout the battle, and secondly, from the area of Chateau Saint-Com, where he describes the battle fought by 9 Parachute Battalion during the days succeeding D-Day. Brigadier James Hill commanded 3 Parachute Brigade, in his own words, as the oldest man in the brigade at the advanced age of 31.
You'll remember that the divisional task was to protect the left flank of 21 Army Group and to secure a firm base for that army to break out. Now, the 3rd Brigade share of that task was really twofold. First of all, we had to carry out works of destruction. The Merville Battery had to be eliminated, about which you heard this morning, and we had 5 bridges to destroy in the south, the main east-west road bridge at Troarn, a road and railway bridge at Bure, a road bridge at Robome, and another bridge at Barraville. After we'd done that, we had to deny the enemy the use of the high ground from exclusive of Breville in the north to the sawmill area in the south, and in addition carry out long-range patrols to endeavour to disrupt the enemy communication. Now, the interesting thing here to me, I think, was the selection of tasks for battalions, and I found, commanding this brigade for 2.5 years in war, that this was nearly always easy. And the reason really is that battalions are temperamentally as different as chalk from cheese. They're really exactly like children. They have their strong points and their weak points, and therefore those sort of selections are easy. First of all, let us take the Canadian battalion. This battalion was full of vitality, joie de vivre, and elan. And I knew very well that for the first 48 hours, every chap would be trying to win a VC. And therefore, the tasks I gave them, their main task was to occupy the Le Menil crossroad and carry out offensive defense. But before that, they had the job of clearing DZV, clearing out the enemy command post at Barraville, destroying the bridge at Barraville and the bridge at Robome, and also protecting the left flank of the 9th Battalion during its advance to the battery. I was delighted to have them somewhere near me during the initial stages of the contest. Now then, who was to deal with the battery about which you heard this morning? There was only one battalion, and that was the 9th, and the reason was it was an extremely finicky battalion. They were masters of detail, and although it doesn't sound it this morning, management techniques. And they had a commanding officer who was a remarkably good trainer and a very resolute commander. So they were the ones to deal with the battery. Then I had to detach somebody down to the south on their own, and the obvious battalion for that was the 8th Battalion, and they were a Durham battalion, Durham Light Infantry. They were miners, they were rugged, not very particular, not very fussy, and they were commanded by the redoubtable Alistair Pearson, who succeeded me in the 1st Battalion in North Africa when I was winged, and his fame had spread before him. And when we captured prisoners here early on, they knew Alistair Pearson was down there, and they were extremely afraid of him. I mention that because it's remarkable what individuals can do. Right, so that was so much for the 3 battalions. The way I was going to deal with that was to hold the Lemenos and Combe area in some strength, or I hoped so, and have the detached battalion down in the south. Now then, insofar as brigade headquarters were concerned, in those days we were 180 and we liked to think fighting men. And that being the case, as the brigade was not very strong, we always liked to cite ourselves where we could act in a defensive position. And the area that I actually chose before D-Day for brigade headquarters was about 200 yards the other side of this house in some more buildings, but in fact we ended up here for various reasons that I'll explain later. And last but not least, one's field ambulance. I'd had my life saved in North Africa by parachuting surgeons, and therefore I was very conscious of the all the assets to be gained if you have your field ambulance right up as near the battle area as you can possibly get it in. And their area was here. When you just consider these positions, I think the important thing to realize is that we were facing in two directions. One thinks now always of that direction, but in fact we had just as good a reason to expect a threat from Escoville in that direction as any other. Well, having told you of the glorious conception, I'll now tell you what happened and try and put a little atmosphere into the thing. And, gentlemen, it wasn't a picnic. We started off in the brigade with 2,000 fighting men, and after the 8 days about which we are telling you in this presentation, we lost in the brigade 50 officers and 1,000 other ranks, and in my brigade headquarters we lost 8 officers and 30 other ranks. I was late in arriving. I should have arrived here at 4 o'clock in the morning, or first light, and instead of which, I arrived at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Now, D-Day was postponed 24 hours, and this was simply marvelous for the battalion commanders, people like myself, because for the first time for many days, we were rarely able to sit back with nothing to do and relax. I personally dropped in the flooded valley of the Dives. The whole of that area, as you know from your little handout, was flooded, quarter of a mile from Cabourg, and the problem that all those who dropped there had to face was it. The area was flooded to a depth of 4 feet, the enemy had wired it before flooding it, and there were a lot, many deep ditches. I thought, sophisticated officer, and therefore had tea bags sewn into my battle dress, and it was maddening as brigade commander for 4 hours to make cold tea. And the only reason, really, that we got away with it was I collected a band of chaps, we roped ourselves together with our toggle ropes. These toggle ropes in war were utterly invaluable, and one way and another overcame the obstacles and so on, and I struggled out on the edge of the DZ, I suppose now, looking back, quarter to six or something in the morning. But that was useful, because I was able to contact the Canadian battalion, find out what had happened. They cleared the DZ. They were still held up. They were having trouble in Varaville, and they didn't know the answer to the bridges, but their morale was all right. So I thought, well, what do I do now? I've missed the boat. The most useful thing I can do is to find out what had happened to the 9th Battalion. So by this time I had 42 stragglers, all as wet as I was. I remember amongst the party were two naval parachute chaps, the FOOs, very important, and together with an Alsatian messenger dog, parachuting one, and off we set. And we went down the track, and at 7 o'clock in the morning, as people have already told you, this fantastic fanfare started. And to my horror, there was trees on both sides of the track we were working up. A horrible patter occurred, and we all threw ourselves to the ground. There wasn't really much of a ditch. I lay on top of the mortar platoon, the mortar officer of the 9th Battalion, and then we were hit by close pattern anti-personnel bombing of a squadron or something of either Hurricanes or Spitfires. And really for the first time in war, although I'd seen quite a bit of it before then, I really smelt and tasted death. It was quite horrible, and it's something you can do. I got up on my arms. The place smelt of cordite and everything. I looked, and there was a leg in the road, and I thought, by God, that's mine. I knew I'd been hit. I then saw it had a brown boot on it, and there was only one man in the brigade who got away with wearing American brown boots, and that was the mortar officer on whom I was lying. So I got to my feet. There was only one other out of the party which could get to his feet, who was my defense platoon commander, and the rest were, as it happened, either dying or dead. So your first problem, what do? Do you look after the wounded and tend them, or is your job to push on? Well, it obviously your job is to push on. So what we did was to give morphine to all the chaps who were going, took the morphia off the chaps who were dead, handed it to the other, and moved on. And a memory that I can't get out of my mind, and sometimes I wished I could, was that as the two of us pushed off, all these other chaps, every one of whom died, gave us a chair as we went. Right, the next thing, one arrived at the 9th Battalion, and this was very helpful because I was briefed what had happened at the battery, that they were held up to the north of Le Plain, and they only had about 90 chaps. The medical officer sees me, and the bloody fellow told me that I looked bad for morale. And I told him that if he'd been swimming for 4 hours and had lost his left cheek, that he wouldn't feel all that hot either. So anyhow, he did all he should do. So then I thought, well, what do you do now? I'm nowhere near my brigade headquarters. And I decided to go and see the divisional commander to brief him on the 9th Battalion and find out what had happened on the rest of the front. So I borrowed a bicycle, and a chap pushed me, and I went happily down the road into divisional headquarters, where I saw General Richard Gale, who was in extremely good form, and he told me, he said, well, James, you'll be delighted to know that your brigade has carried out all its initial tasks. All the bridges are blown, the battery is taken. So, of course, that made me feel $1 million. And then we had a splendid chap in the division called Old Technicolor. And Old Technicolor was the ADMS, and he was the most decorated man in the division. He'd fought in the White Russian War, 14-18 War and everything else, and he decided to look after me, and I was put on an operating slab in the main dressing station, and as I passed out, I remember a heavy concentration coming down in Ronville, which was, I think, their first major counterattack. In due course, when I'd recovered and was conscious and good form again, Old Technicolor said, I'll now take you up to your brigade headquarters, and I was extremely grateful. He got out his jeep and his driver. I sat in the back seat, and off we went. So when we just got out of the village of Ronville, half a dozen Germans crossed the road, and to my horror and disgust, he told his driver to pull up, opened his little pocket of the jeep, drew out a revolver, covered in every sort of armband. He pursued the Germans into the bush, obviously hoping to increase his decorations and come back for a prisoner. And here was an extremely important brigade commander sitting bolt upright and rather tender in the back. However, after a few minutes, he returned, looking rather shamefaced, I'm glad to say, and drove me up here, and I arrived here on this spot at 4 o'clock, where I met Colonel Alistair Pearson. The thing was working well. He'd come here to take over the brigade in my absence. He briefed me about what had happened in his battalion. He was in good form, except he'd been shot through his left hand, which is always extremely painful, and so I sent him off back to the sawmill area and took over. And then, of course, the first thing I had to do was to take stock. Brigade headquarters. I looked round, couldn't find the brigade major. Didn't seem to be one. I then looked for my DAA and QMG, and he wasn't there. And I found out later, and he was A really splendid young chap. He'd been to the staff college. He was aged 25. They chose the age in those days. And he had landed with his stick on the other side of the Dive. And we heard from the French afterwards that he'd gathered 7 or 8 chaps. And instead, it's terribly easy when you land a long way away just to hold your hands up and retire gracefully from the contest. But they'd had a tremendous battle. The whole lot had been wiped out fighting. And he is now buried in a small churchyard on the other side of the river. No commando liaison officer. This was a real loss. Peter Haig Thomas, 3 years in the Canadian boat, in the Cambridge boat, stroke the last year or 2 years, a marvellous chap, and very important for me, linking with the Canadian, linking with the commandos on my left. But he was killed 10 minutes after landing. No padre, Roman Catholic padre, Padre McVeigh, always carried a large shillelagh. I found out what happened to him. He was captured by the Germans, having no weapons, so he set about them with his shillelagh. They refused to accept him as a priest. They defrocked him, and they sent him up to the concentration camp on the Baltic, where those RAF chaps did their tremendous escape. And no sailors. Now, this was important, because up here in this wooded area, we had to fend for ourselves and were dependent on the Navy. Now, gentlemen, the lesson here is you've got to be ambidextrous. And everybody, for instance, in brigade headquarters, always was able to do 2 jobs with competence. And as a result of it, what happened on this occasion, my staff captain was brigade major. I think it was my intelligence officer who was DAA and QMG. Defense platoon commander was a jack of all trades. And in fact, the thing was working. The only thing was the staff captain, being smart, rather more comfortably minded than I was, had decided this was a very nice spot and he would establish here and put the defense platoon up in the gap where the brigade headquarters was originally to be. Another mention here, gentlemen, of being ambidextrous is when you listen to these stories, Alistair Pearson had one hand, he had left-hand shot, but he had a perfectly good right hand, so he could get on with it. Alan Parry, and another story I shall tell you later of another key chap, had one leg, and you can get on with that, and I had a very good-looking right cheek and no left cheek, and I find you could perfectly well get on with that. So you can be ambidextrous in every way. A good parachute soldier, I always said, should be capable of turning his hands to anything, and I had no way of firing the Arethusa, and eventually a sailor turned up in a 22 set. But this didn't resolve the problem. I went to Colonel Bradbrook next door in the brickworks, and there he had a very handsome and good-looking, a magnificent man who was the regimental sergeant major. I asked him if I could borrow him, got him over here, and then told him his task was to fire the guns for the Arethusa. Chap had never fired anything except his rifle and his 10 guns, but this didn't deter him. And the remarkable thing was that within a few hours, he and the sailor had got the thing going, and for the next 4 days were most effective. So it just shows what can happen when you're in a jam. The battalions at that time, this is on the night of D-Day and the early morning of D+1, 8th Battalion, 250 strong, down on the triangle. They had a wonderful story, which used to be told at this presentation. There's one thing I think I must mention there, a remarkable job done by our engineer officer who was attached to them with the task of blowing the bridges in Troyes. They had a scattered drop, but better than the others, and Colonel Pearson realized that they were gathering rather slower than he'd anticipated. The bridge had to be blown well before first light, or at first light. So Major Rosevear and 2 jeeps and the sappers set off. They got caught up in a sort of car block, or what it, road block, this side of Troyes, extracted themselves, and then drove through Troyes rather late, just as the Germans were standing to. They shot up, I don't know whether they killed anybody, but they shot them up as they dashed through the town, got to the bridge, blew a hole, and that was that. Later on in the morning, Colonel Pearson and Major Rosevere decided that the hole wasn't quite big enough, so they went back with a company strong and blew it again. I'm absolutely delighted that Major Rosevere, who was commonly known as Rosie, that his son, I think, is one of the students on the course, and I met him on the first day of our presentation, but it was a marvellous effort. Now, the Canadian battalion, 300 strong, the 9th battalion, still up in the Le Plan area, they were late in being relieved by the commandos, 90. Now, so much for that, gentlemen. I made my headquarters in that little room at the top of the steps, and I used to be able to get out and sit there and really see the battle area. It was a jolly good position, although it was rather illegal, I think, being so near your main dressing station. The operating part of the brigade was dug in that wood, and most of the defense platoon was in the gap that there was over there. Again, I won't dwell, other people have told you, but you can imagine our feelings with this glorious view, seeing an air landing brigade turn up in the evening. Now, at 9 o'clock the next morning on D-Day, I was on my perch, and who should come down the road but my brigade major? And I was delighted and pleased, except his leg stuck out sideways. And it wouldn't have mattered so much that if my leg wasn't sticking out sideways. And when you got both the two of them, it was really infuriating. And, however, when I heard his story, you couldn't help forgiving him. And what had happened to him was this. He's Brigadier Bill Collingwood, probably some of the senior of you may well know him. He's retired now, but anyhow, as they came over the coast, his aircraft was badly shot up, and he didn't jump out, but was blown out before the time. And his parachute, nothing worked, and he was hanging on the static line. The other chaps came back in. And as the aeroplane staggered back, which it did across the channel, it was one of the few cases that I've known in parachuting where they were able to pull him in. And he had a 60-pound kit bag on his leg, and he was doing this from the time it got over the beaches, turned round and got back over the British coast. The aeroplane landed, false landing at Odium, and after all that, and it can't have been a very happy experience to start your battling, he had the guts to get into a motor car, order it to drive to Dunampney, and he turned up with the air landing brigade. And now in my old age, I can turn round, which I wouldn't have said then, such was the stuff that parachute brigade majors were made of.
The next tape is of Brigadier James Hill telling the story of 9 parabattalions' battle in the days succeeding D-Day in the area of the Chateau Saint-Quentin.
Well, gentlemen, at this stand, I'm going to try and tell you a story, I'm afraid most inadequately, of 5 days of what I think was some of the toughest fighting that I certainly personally saw in 5 years of war. And those days are June the 8th to the 12th, or D plus 2 to D plus 6. And the story covers the 9th Battalion. During that period of time, numbers fluctuated from 90 to 270 down to 190. And also the 5th Battalion of the Black Watch. Now, this really, we tell this story, I think, to try and get you a bit of atmosphere. And to appreciate it, I would ask you to put yourselves in the position of a young chap in the 9th Battalion taking part. You remember, they'd never seen a shot fired in anger before D-Day, not a single chap. They'd had an appalling drop. They'd stormed the battery. They'd captured and held Le Plan for about 12 to 14 hours longer than they anticipated. And 48 hours after dropping, they turned up in this wood, minus most of their heavy equipment, and not exactly fresh. Gentlemen, it is a story of go, guts and gumption, and I like to think of hanging on by the skin of your teeth. I try to keep the 5 days separate and to give each one a name, otherwise it becomes a bit of a jumble. Now, on the first of the 5 days, I call it the day that the activity switched from the bridgehead away to my right, up onto the ridge here. The 9th Battalion arrived, if I remember rightly, in the early hours of that morning, and I met Colonel Otway up here, and we discussed what we should do. I'd wanted him originally to hold the area of the chateau and this wood. With 90 men, you couldn't do it. So we agreed he'd hold this area here, and he would try and deny the chateau to the enemy by patrolling. And his plan was to hold the line of this hedgerow here to that red house, 200 yards away, not as much, by A Company. The line of this hedge here, which is rather a good position with this sunken road behind, with B, his battalion headquarters in the middle, and what he called C was a semi-reserve company, not very strong at all, obviously just over a platoon, in the back, facing that way. Now, on the first day, at first light, out went the patrol to the chateau. It was empty, the tables were laid, and they got £500 worth of francs out of a box. That was a good omen. And at 12 o'clock, they were dug in here. A platoon, or what have you, came across here in rather a desolatory manner. They let them get right up and shot them up. Well, then, to their surprise after that, two, if not three more attacks, with far more chaps in, came across here, this area. And they held their fire, did all they should do, dealt with them, captured a number of prisoners. And then they found out why there was this rather peculiar form of soldiering going on. And these poor fellows were a bicycle battalion. They'd bicycle flat out from Le Havre. As they came up the hill, they were halted, and their CO had directed them in company strength up across here. One of the reasons for the success was that the CO had a little fire group, and it consisted of the regimental sergeant major, the one Vickers gun they had, a Bren gun, and a few riflemen. And wherever the contest got hot, these chaps came up to support the people in this hedge or that one. Now, during the course of the day, Breville was occupied, so the line of communications was cut. At 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the staff captain got two jeeps of food, ammunition, 2 3-inch mortars, which were invaluable, and 3 Vickers up to the battalion. That evening, my brigade LO came up to see the CO. As he drove out of here in his jeep, he was badly shot up from down the road at Breville. The whole of his jaw was shot away. I went and saw him in the field ambulance. The advantage of having the field ambulance there, he was kept alive. Now he has a new jaw, marvellous sets of snappers, quite good looking, and he's made a marvellous life for himself. Literally no jaw at all. During this day, there was continuous fighting on the Canadian front. And just to show how uncertain it was, I went up to the forward platoon of the Canadians on the road that leads off to Cherbourg. And when I got there in the house on the right, they gleefully told me that the Germans were in the houses there on the other side of the road on the left. It was rather a matey operation, and I soon had that one, I like to think, put right. Right, now that's the end of the first day. Quite a nice day, very successful, but not untiring.